There we go. So let me read you from the beginning of chapter 4. This is very famous stuff again. And here we go, starting verse 1. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel also brought an offering, fat portions, from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are a curse. You are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will become a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Not that one. That's it. That's it. There we go. We'll do that much. Good. I was distracted by the land of Nod. Now, as we go through this, I want you to bear a little thing in mind. This is from Stephen Levitt, who's a sort of famous economist. His book Freakonomics, which came out a few years ago. I'm sure many of you have read it. But this is a little. Basically looks at sort of the phenomena of strange sort of things and tries to work out why they happen. Anyway, this is a little bit from it. In 1958, a New York City man, Robert Lane, decided to call his baby son Winner. The Lanes, who lived in a housing project in Harlem, already had several children, each with a pretty normal name. But this boy, Robert Lane, had a special feeling with this one. Winner Lane. How could he fail with a name like that? 3 years later, the Lanes had their seventh and final child, another baby boy. For reasons that no one could quite pin down, Robert decided to name this boy Loser. First a winner, and now a loser. But if Winner Lane could hardly be expected to fail, could Loser Lane possibly succeed? It's a completely true story, winner and loser. Anyway, bear that in mind as we go through this. Back to the passage. It's a gripping narrative, isn't it? It's a sort of Shakespearean tragedy. You've got all the elements of rivalry between brothers. You've got murder. You've got soul-searching. You've got evil. It's a huge grandiose kind of story. And I think, therefore, it can be treated as quite sort of grandiose. It can be treated as this is the very first murder. This is the first murder. This is where we see sin really revealing itself. But actually, I think that's to miss the point in some ways. Because actually, this is the first story, really, of life. It's the first story of life. It's the first story of what things are like now. If Genesis 1 to 3 has been why things are like they are as they are now, this is the first instance of how things are like they are now. This is life. This is what life is about. And like life for us now, this life has the same elements that are always present in our lives, in lives throughout history. And those elements, I think, are sin, grace, salvation. Sin, grace, and salvation. They're always present. Wherever we go, and they're present here. So firstly, sin, which is what we always love to talk about. We just love it. In fact, I was doing a wedding yesterday here, and some people came along, and they said, we've been to your church 4 or 5 times, and every time we come, we hear a talk about giving money and tithing. Every single time we come, we hear a talk about giving. It's happened 4 or 5 times, and it's every time we've come. Do you only ever talk about giving money? And I said, no, normally we talk about sin. We don't always talk about money, we don't always talk about sin. In fact, we rarely talk about sin. But I'm going to talk a little bit about sin. But if you love hearing about sin, can I recommend, as Phil did last week, John's talk from a few weeks back on sin. In fact, I think he's going to be repeating it later, but it's just about sin. So if you want more sin, there's more of that coming. But anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about it. And I think here, above everything, where does sin come from? Where does it start? Everybody knows sin when it's murder. Everyone can see Cain's sin of murdering his brother. But can you see the beginnings of it? And I think the first question is, what is the difference between Cain and Abel? What is the difference? Well, there is no difference, really. Read the narrative. They're both the same. They're both good people doing the good work. One tilling the land, one looking after the animals. It's not the case that Cain is some sort of perfect child who goes to church and reads his Bible and says his prayers. He's not just a good Christian boy, or Abel is this terrible person, or the other way around. They're both the same. They're both the same. They're both doing the right stuff. Often I think it's depicted as Abel bad, Cain good, or Cain bad, Abel good, but they're both the same. And yet, God says to Cain, sin is crouching at your door. Sin is crouching at your door. Its desire is to have you. Its desire is to master you. What is he saying? Cain and Abel look on the surface exactly the same. But why is it that sin is crouching at Cain's door and not at Abel's? Because I think there's something wrong with Cain's heart. And even Cain can't really see it. And I think this is why the metaphor is used like this, to be crouching down, because this is the point that God is trying to make. The point is, sin crouches down because it tries to make itself small. It tries to make itself hidden. It tries to make itself insignificant. It crouches down because it doesn't want to be seen. It doesn't want us to go, oh, I can see that. I can identify that nice and early. It crouches down, making it, oh, it's not really a big deal. It's not really a big deal. It's just that thing. It's crouching down to make itself hidden. But also, it's crouching down so that it can pounce up. So that it can pounce up. Because God's point here is that sin is not just a choice. It's not really a choice. It's a power. It has great agency. It has great potency. At any moment, it can spring from being this insignificant thing that we ignore to something that is huging and engulfing. And it wants to have dominion over us. It wants to have power over us. It's not just a choice. It is a power. And so I don't want to dwell much on sin, but I want to ask you, if I may, what are your crouching sins? What are those little things hidden, ready to pounce, that we think are insignificant? The things that we sort of make excuses for. You know, I'm not unfriendly, I'm just very focused. I'm not tight, I'm just incredibly careful with money. I'm not bitchy, I just like exposing the truth. My favorite, I'm not bitter against the opposite sex, I'm just experiencing righteous moral outrage. What are the things that just crouch there and we excuse them? I obviously am including myself in this. It always crouches down, but it will always have power and dominion over us if we let it coil up. We can decide to stay, for instance, bitter with our parents. We can decide to do that, but if we do that, its power then poisons us. It then overcomes us. And I think there's no one more under the influence of that power than someone who doesn't even think it's there, that doesn't even understand that it's there. And this is the case with Cain. He doesn't even know that it's there. He doesn't even know that this thing, with all its potential, is sitting there ready to explode if he lets it, if, as God says, he chooses not to master it. But let's be honest, shall we? This, as I said, is life post Adam and Eve. This is life as it is for us now. This is, I mean, I don't want to say real life, because I don't think it is real life, but it's real life as we understand it. Sin is always present. It's always present. So let's not get into the trap of thinking, hey, actually, we are not affected. Let's not be Christians who pretend that we are actually perfect. Thank you very much. The idea that we're all unsusceptible, or we're good enough not to be challenged by sinfulness. Let's just accept that we are. You know, we shouldn't be so naive or so sort of triumphalist to think we can conquer sin. Sin is always there. Sin is always present. It's what we choose to do with it when we can see it beginning to uncoil, and what we choose to do with it when we know that we failed. It's always a factor. But so too, and so importantly, throughout life is grace. Sin is present and grace is present. Now here, I think this is really incredible, because this is right at the beginning of the Old Testament, and this is where God defies the stereotypes that people want to put on him. If you ask the average person on the street, what is God like, who wouldn't call themselves a Christian, they would say, well, God is angry and evil and judgmental, and you have to try and do the right thing for him. You have to do all these things for him. That's what God's like. Or a secondary stereotype would be, oh, well, God just loves everyone. God is love. You know, there's nothing more than him just loving. Loving, loving, loving. He loves everyone. There are lots of gods. He loves us all, whatever we do, however we live our lives. God just loves. He's love, love, love. Those would be the two stereotypes. But here, right at the beginning of Genesis, God chooses to fit into those stereotypes. He chooses not to fit into those stereotypes. He refuses to decide between mercy and judgment. He's not some sort of cosmic policeman who suddenly turns up and goes, you were wrong, you were wrong. Can you see how he initiates? He turns up and no one has asked him to come. No one has called out to him. He turns up of his own initiative straight away. Before anything actually has gone wrong, he turns up. He initiates. He comes towards us. He doesn't get there after the murder. He comes there before anything goes wrong. Policemen turn up when things go wrong. God is not the cosmic policeman. He turns up before anything has gone wrong. It says that Cain's face was downcast. He was depressed. His face had fallen. And that God turns up then, when this man is feeling depressed. I think it's why people who have experienced God, have experienced a conversion, a dramatic conversion to God, will always talk about how actually they could see God working in their lives before they actually chose to respond to him. They can see a sense in which God calls, in which God initiates. It's always the case. However much people have gone, and then, you know, I decided to give myself to God, actually, they can always see God moving towards them, initiating, and they respond. That's what God's always like. He always starts it. There's a song about the chorus. It's a terrible song about I found Jesus, which is a great sort of communication of what it can feel like to become a Christian. But actually, Jesus is the one who finds us and calls us and beckons us and always begins. We just respond to that. And it's what happens here. Before anything has gone wrong, God initiates. He steps in. He comes before anyone has called. And what does he do when he gets there? He gently affirms. he gently affirms. He doesn't come as a teacher, but he comes as a counselor. You see, a teacher assumes people do not know the truth and then tell them the truth. That's what a teacher does. But God doesn't do that here. He's not assuming that Cain doesn't know what's going on. He comes with questions rather than answers. And he affirms, therefore, Cain's ability to get it. He says to Cain, you, like all humankind, have potential. You have potential, and I'm going to draw it out of you. He comes with questions. What are you doing? Can you not see this? I want you to discover it. So he initiates and he affirms, but he also uncovers. And this is where it gets interesting, I think. His question is, why are you angry? Why are you angry? God blesses Abel, but he doesn't bless Cain. Cain gets angry. Why does Cain get angry? Why is he so murderous? Is it because, you know, he doesn't understand? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think we can only understand this when we get to grips with, and this is why I read that bit from Freakonomics at the start, the significance of their names. The significance of their names. Because names in the Bible are always significant. Simon has his name changed to Peter, because he needs to reflect the fact that God is going to build his church on him. Abraham becomes Abraham because he's going to be the father of nations. Saul changed his name to Paul. There is deep significance in the names in the Bible. They may not be for us, but there's deep significance for names in the Bible. Cain means this, productive and useful. Abel means worthless and a nobody. This is the very first instance of winner and loser. Cain, firstborn, productive, useful. Abel, worthless and a nobody. Why is this? Why do they have these names? It's not an accident. Names in the Bible are not an accident. There is only one possible reason that they have these names. It's because Cain was loved by his parents and Abel was not. It's the only possible. And there's a hint of this at the beginning. When Cain is born, Eve rejoices and she says, "The Lord has helped me bring forth this child." Then it says, "And Abel was born." Cain is the favorite. He's the blue-eyed boy. He's the perfect son. And he is named Good. Abel, not liked by his parents. Why? Who knows? But not liked by his parents. Useless, worthless, a nobody. Winner, loser. How could anyone do that? How could anyone name their children like that? And yet, in 1958, this guy did. Winner and loser. Parents can do that. They can do that. Now, I think we can probably admit that we're not going to call our children winner and loser. I hope not. If you have called your children winner and loser, please come and talk to me afterwards. But we do label people, don't we? Especially our children. We say, this one's the creative one. This one's the slightly rebellious one. This one is the leader. This one's the follower. This one's like this. This one's like that. And we definitely label other people that we know. She's like this. He's like that. We label people. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with identifying and trying to draw out and encourage sides of people's characters, especially our children. It's important as parents to try and grow them to the people they're supposed to be. But what I do think is that when labels are placed on people, the effect that it can have, the detrimental effect that it can have, is incredibly powerful. And you can see it with Cain and Abel. Why would Cain be unhappy when his brother Abel, the nobody, the one that everyone hates, the useless one, the one that is completely rejected, the one that has never done anything right in his life, the one that has gone, oh, Abel, again, Why would Cain be unhappy when Abel, possibly for the first time, receives affirmation, an affirmation from God? God is pleased with him. God says yes to Abel. Possibly for the first time he has ever received any sort of praise in his life, he is called loser. Why would Cain, his brother, who is called winner, be angry? Why would he be angry? Because Cain's identity is entirely made up of his difference to his brother. He is the good one, his brother is the bad one. He is the winner, his brother is the loser. As soon as that is challenged, Cain's whole identity begins to unravel. Miroslav Volf wrote a commentary on this, and he puts it very, very well. He says this: first came envy. Cain was angry because Abel, who is literally a nobody, would be regarded, and Cain, he, who is clearly a somebody, should be disregarded. Cain's identity was constructed from the start in relation to Abel. He was great because he was better than Abel. And when God favored Abel, Cain either has to readjust his identity or eliminate Abel. When Cain is confronted by God's measure of what truly matters, what is truly great, he has to exclude both God and Abel. Because his premise goes like this: if Abel is who God regards him to be, then I am not what I understand myself to be. The power of sin does not rest on some irrepressible urge of violence, but on the reasoning of the perverted self, which insists on maintaining some sense of false identity. The essence of sin, the essence of Cain's sin, of all sin, is building his identity outside of God. His identity is purely in relation to Abel. He's great because I'm told I'm great. My parents have told I'm great. I'm a good farmer, and I'm better than Abel. As soon as Abel is praised, my identity falls apart, because then who am I? Can you see how fragile it is? Every other commentator says it's strange how Cain's anger just comes out of nowhere. All of a sudden he becomes a murderer. And actually, anger is always irrational. The point, actually, that they don't understand is that anger is never irrational. Anger is the most rational thing in the world. It's rational because it comes from his whole being. It's traced all the way through what his parents named him, how he chose then to accept that identity. And when that identity is crushed, he has to respond in the only possible way, which is to eliminate the thing that is destroying him. He has to eliminate Abel. And it's the truth for all of us. When our identity is built on anything other than God, when things challenge that identity, we'll go berserk. We'll go berserk. Because everything falls apart. But building our identity on God, whose love is entirely secure, who cares for us, who makes us completely safe. Building our lives actually on the rock means that things can come against us, things can challenge us, and our whole identity does not fall apart. We do not go berserk. We do not suddenly go, how am I behaving? Why am I behaving like this? Have you ever felt that? Where did that come from? I do that the whole time. Where on earth did that come from? So God's grace is affirmatory, it's initiative, it initiates rather, but it also convicts, it also exposes where things are at. And sin is always a factor, but grace is always a factor. Grace is always there for us. And so too, and finally, is salvation. if you ask the general person on the street, how can we cooperate with God's grace? God has extended himself to us. What do we need to do? They would say, oh, well, I know how to cooperate. You read your Bible. You do the right thing. You're a good Christian boy or girl. But Cain is doing that. Cain is being a good Christian boy and girl. He is doing everything right. He is the older brother in Jesus' parable of prodigal son. He is the one who gets it all right the whole time. He does everything, ticking all the boxes. So why is his sacrifice not regarded? Well, actually, the Bible answers this exactly. In Hebrews 11, verse 4, by faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous. It's not a question of whether Cain and Abel believed. They both believed. They were both good. They were both trying to do the right thing. But Abel gave his sacrifice in response to a good God, in a response to a God who initiated, in a response to going, all I've got is responding to the promises that you've made, and all I'm doing is resting my life on you because I know I can't achieve anything. I've been told that since the beginning of time. Cain is going, I am great, and you're going to be pleased with my sacrifice because my sacrifice is perfect for you. In fact, my sacrifice is the best sacrifice you've ever received. It's brilliant. There's no faith there. It's all worked. It's doing everything to try and make God happy with him. He is doing all the right things. But God turns everything upside down, as he always does, and he says, I choose you because you've responded to me as you should. You've responded to me in response to what I've done for you, that I am the good God, that I'm the one who does it, and you've responded by faith. That's why he chose him. In the story of Winner and Loser Lane, Loser Lane does actually succeed, and Winner Lane, in fact, the only thing sort of notable about him is how long his crime spree is and how much time he spends in prison. Loser Lane, on the other hand, went to prep school on a scholarship. He graduates from Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. He joins the NYPD, which was his mother's longtime wish. He makes detective, eventually becomes sergeant. And although he never hides his name, many people find it uncomfortable using it. So he says people either call me Jimmy or James or whatever they want to call me. And once in a while, they throw in a French twist and call me Lousier. To his police colleagues, he's always known as Lou. Now, I say that because, actually, I think this is a sign, a little bit, of how God works. That he chooses the weak things. He chooses the things that are not all that. And he makes them shine. Because this is the salvation and this is the justice of God. This is the redemption of God. He chooses not the special ones. He chooses the weak and those who've been labeled by parents, by friends, by teachers, by bullies as something. And he says, I will tell you who you really are. I will tell you who you really are. You're my daughter. You're my son. He speaks a better word. And it shows his love for justice, his love for the right thing, his love for those who have never experienced justice, who've always been downtrodden. But also, and this is the extraordinary thing, is that God's love is not just for the downtrodden. It's not just for the weak and the needy. We can't limit goodness. We can't limit God's goodness in that way. It's so much bigger than that. Because right at the end, he approaches Cain and he says, where's your brother? And Cain's not even repentant. Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? How do I know? But God says, well, this is the curse that you've brought upon yourself. But ultimately, I'm going to put my mark on you. I'm going to say to you that you will not be harmed, that people will not kill you. I am going to put this sign on you that says, I will look after you. Even though throughout this, even when I came to you early and said, these were the problems, this is what's going to happen, can you not see this sin crouching at your door, even though you went ahead with it, even though now when I confront you with it, you say, well, who's my brother? I'm still going to put my mark on you. I'm still going to look after you. I'm still going to show my compassion towards you. Because God's love for justice for Abel is only matched, and in fact, is only superseded by his compassion for Cain. Because this is the grace of God. So can I encourage you, be an Abel. Be an Abel, don't be a Cain. Because when you're an Abel, you can react like God reacts to Cain. God, who sees all the things that are wrong with him, tries to help him, point them out, but ultimately still loves him, still has compassion on him when he messes up. Be an Abel to your children. Be an Abel to your colleagues. Be an Abel to the people for whom you can see all the things that are wrong with them. All the things that are really annoying and wrong with them. And treat them with compassion. Counsel them. Draw it out of them. But still love them. Cains will always hate Abels. Abels will never hate Cains. God treats us like that. So treat other people like that. Amen. Let's stand, shall we?